Can you give us a bit of a flavour of managing the lab and the problems?
Well, in the early days, when I first started, films were processed in tanks, and these tanks were, apparently they were ex-submarine tanks, 24-gallon size, thick Bakelite tanks, developer in there, so you had 24 gallons of developer in there. My job, of course, was to make the developer up when that used to have to be made up again. And then I graduated, so I did the development. Well, you used to have three films hanging on clips on the stainless steel rod, and you had to put them in by hand, set the clock, you know, and 8 minutes at 68 degrees, and then take them out of that after the bell went, and into a rinse, and then out of there, into the fixer solution, sodium thiosulfite, and, you know, and that's how it went on. And then, of course, you come to the drawing. Well, this was when we had a shed, University Cameras, this is, they had a shed down Searle Street, where the lab was, and a woman lived in the house, and we were in the sheds. It got so you get so many films that the drawing cabinet, where you could get perhaps 20 films and something like that, you had too many films, you had a backup then, the films were all washed and wanted to be dry. So we used to, if it was a decent day, we used to hang them on our clothesline. Yeah, I mean, can you believe it? I mean, and you think back now and you think, well, where all the dust flying about and whatever, you know. And you're trying to, but mainly in them days, of course, that was just contact printing, a little bit of enlarging, but in the main, it was contact printing. And then, of course, we had the glazing machines, which are the old rotary glazing machines there. And that was another one. I should have said that we purchased BTE, British Trade Equipments, in Willesden. And they made all the glazing machines for Kodak. And we purchased that when Kodak off of Kodak. And carried on making glazer cloths at Anglia and Devonshire Road. Upstairs on a big old table there, I used to take the cloth down to this woman in Ruislip, who used to then stitch them all up for selling, and the government used to buy most of them. And I used to drive them up to Carlisle, to the maintenance unit up there for the RAF. And,
how did these things work then, with a cloth?
Oh, well, yeah, well, you had a glazing drum. If you could afford to have one with a chrome drum, that was the best one. The others were stainless steel. And it had this wide cloth, which would come in various, like 15, 18 and 24 inch. And after the prints were washed, this was continually moving. That was on with a small motor on a chain drive at the top. And it turned the drum and the cloth, because it had a squeegee roller here. That used to come up under the cloth, and that used to squeeze these wet prints that you laid on this cloth as it was going. As it come there, it used to squeegee them onto the plate, which was this chrome plate or chrome drum. And by the time they went round on with the heaters on the go, of course, and hopefully they'd drop off the other end and be, you know, nice glossy prints. If you wanted them semi-matte, you turned the print upside down, and it went through, and that dried the prints off. And then it was up to the girls to then trim the edges, so they're all eighth of an inch all around and all that sort of thing.
So when did the fully automated machines first start to come in?
Oh dear, oh dear. Well, we had the first automated ones when we were in St Andrews Hill. We couldn't accommodate any in Rose Crescent, and that was the main reason we moved, because you couldn't have got a machine up those stairs there. They were huge things, and need a lot of looking after them. We had quite a lot of accidents with them and all that sort of thing. And the first colour processing machine we had was a Williamson, no longer in existence, of course. And it was just one of these that just kept going through these rollers and then out. And then in those days, you just go through a pre-dryer, yeah. And so it dried them in this cabinet, and then it'd come out and it'd move on to this, like a huge plate, a glazing drum, that was a good 5 foot. But before it went on, it used to pre-wet them again. So you had to dry them and then re-wet and then carry on. And then, of course, it had automatic replenishment, so depending on how many metres of paper went through, so it replenished a bit more developed or bleach or whatever.
And this was all black and white
that
initially?
Was colour.
Oh, that was colour, that was the first colour.
We had the black and white one, and That was a huge thing as well. That was an Ilford machine, who were probably the leaders in making that sort of equipment at that time. And then also with the film processor, that was a massive thing. And that used to put 8 films on a rod, and you put it on the end of the machine, the arms would come down, pick it up, take it right up, pull it over and put it into the tank, and then they'd be like shark's teeth. And as the arms come up to pick the next rod up, these arms would just inch it on one move on the shark's teeth, so it got a bit further in the tank, till it got to the end of that tank, and then it would pick it up again and put it in the next one. And then, of course, occasionally they used to drop them. Yeah. So when you're in the pitch dark, and you hear it go crunch, oh, God, yeah, you think, however many films are there, you know? Because you could get 6 rods into the developing tank at one time, and 8 on each rod. That's 48 films. Don't sound many, does it? Not when you're doing sort of 300 or 400 a day, but when you've got to explain to all that amount of customers what's happened. Yeah.
And it was all same-day processing, was it?
No, it used to be about 3 days, yeah. And it was only later on that we got it down to 1 day. With faster machines, basically, mm-hmm. and also faster printers. I mean, that was where you could, with some of them printers, you do 2,000 prints an hour. But in those days, they were quite a bit slower. Yeah. And I suppose the biggest problem we had, well, the most well-known name that we mucked things up for, or the machine did, was Mr. Butler, R.A. Butler.
Oh, he was a Home Secretary, was he not, at one point?
Yeah. he did a round-the-world trip. But I had to do the explaining, but it wasn't our fault, it was Kodak. And they'd had a complete calamity. And, yeah, he lost most of his films. Okay. They did write a covering letter, yeah. But, I mean, I still had to give it to him and explain. Yeah, because he used to bring his films in there and, yeah, try and explain it to him. And because you're sort of on the top line, you know, before he comes, sort of thing. Not a pleasant job. And I had Steve, when he left school, I thought to give him a job, because he was on about, he wanted some money to get a car and all that sort of thing. So I said, well, you come work for us, and eventually, when you're old enough, I'll perhaps buy a car. So he came and worked there, and I got him in the end to do film development. Well, it did crash on one occasion when he was in there. Of course, he panicked and he came hurtling out after me, you know. Oh, yeah, that's all right. So, of course, I'll go in there and try and do my best. But anyhow, years later, he was on about work and this, that, and now. I said, well, any time, Steve, you want a job, mate, come back and you can carry on where you left off. Father, he said, I won't go in that so-and-so place. He said, if you paid me £1,000, yeah, oh dear, that put the wind up then. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's how we did it. And again, we were on the roll paper, and we were on, oh dear, 1,000 metre rolls, something like that. Huge rolls of paper. Mm. On colour and black and white, and then by that time, of course, it was all turning over from contact prints and the occasional postcard or half plate print or whatever. It was changing over then to the new sort of size of 6x4, mm. which matched the format of the 35mm camera. Mm. So, in actual fact, you could almost print it without cutting anything off that was on the negative.
Yeah.
You always got people who come in and say, there's half a head there that was my granny, and you cut it off. But you could never get them to understand that the machine needed to be able to mask off a little bit of the negative to prevent white light coming through, because if it did, the thing would just be haywire. I mean, white light coming through for white, for colour paper and so forth, and the exposure would be wrong, and everything was wrong. So that's why they always made it say it did, but they could never understand that. A lot of other things. One of the other complaints you used to get used to be colour failure. And a classic example used to be when you see the fields of rape all brightly yellow and the sky nice and blue, they couldn't understand, and you try to say, well, it's reciprocity failure, you know, you've got complementary colour and opposing the primary sort of thing, and they couldn't accept the fact that that blue sky could change the colour of the yellow. If you made it so the yellow was dead right, the sky would go sort of reddy yellow or reddy blue. they just couldn't, you know, all that sort of thing. And that's, it was on occasions like that when Carol used to sort of, if she was confronting the customer, she'd perhaps lose her cool a bit. And on one occasion, I happened to be standing behind, and she didn't know it. And this bloke was going at her left, right and centre a bit, the colour of this, that and the other. And she was putting up a good defence, and in the end she said, "Oh, well, take the bloody things to Boots." No. Yeah, terrible.
In his heyday then, what sort of volumes were you doing at Anglia Photo Works?
Well, in her heyday, of course, that, as I say, was when we were doing the American, all the American bases, and that was for the staff of the American bases, not for the work, not for the American Air Force as such. It was all from the BXs and so mm-hmm. forth. And I suppose, and at the same time, we were doing the processing for four mail order companies, all under the same group: J.D. Williams, Oxendales, two others, which I've forgotten the name. So, and they used to send theirs down in a big case by train to Ely Station. We used to pick them up from Ely Station, bring them back to Cambridge, process them, and then send them back again by train. I had a good experience there with the man. I had to go up there when I tried to get the work. I went up there to meet the board of directors who were going to discuss whether they should have this in their catalogues, free film service as well, they were going to do, that's what they wanted to do. And there was me there and the board of directors, Alan Street, Dougie And, who was the CEO or whatever. And he didn't say a lot, and these other people were quizzing me all the while. And then when it came to the end, we had a meal in the director's room and all that sort of thing, and when it came to the end sort of thing, and he said, "Well, you haven't told me one thing. What's in it for us?" Yeah, but yeah, we did that for a long while, yeah.
So the kind of quantities then would have been phenomenal, would they?
Yeah, well, they were quite, yeah, they, as the week went on, you got less. Monday was always the big day, weekend people out, you know, photographing the seaside and things like that. And I don't know, I suppose. We say phenomenal, I suppose, up to about 1,000, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. That's 1,000 prints or 1,000 films?
Films.
1,000 films.
Yeah. Up to 1,000. Yeah. So, you know, sort of Thursday or Friday, you'd perhaps be down to, perhaps could even be, well, in the winter time, a lot less, of course. But in summertime, probably down to about half that, I think, mm-hmm. or probably even less.
Mm-hmm.
The sepia bit, that was a real, you know, it was a fashion at one time there. Even in the days when I was first starting there, you know, quite a lot of orders have come in and they want a whole plate print, sepia toned, you know, and terrible job that was because it all smelled of rotten eggs, you know, you had to bleach the image out, yeah, to, so it's just a ghost image, and then it went back, I can't tell you chemical now, but it went back in the other one where you got your sepia print. And you could sort of make it more dense or light or whatever. Invariably, you got a complaint, you know, it's too dark or too light, do it again. But, yeah, not a pleasant process.
And interesting that sepia tone has kind of progressed through and it's now a mode on most digital cameras.
Yeah, that's right.
It's still popular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now you just turn the button, don't you?
Yeah.
Turn it that way or that way.
Yeah, yeah. Or take it one way and then play around with Photoshop.
That's
afterwards,
right,
on your
afterwards,
computer.
Yeah.
Were there risks for photo labs of having pornographic material submitted to them?
There's plenty of opportunities to, you know, take on pornographic work. You know, anyone who wanted to set up purely doing that, and if it could have been legalised or whatever.
Yeah.
But we had one or two near misses all the while with it, and you couldn't be off it with the American bases.
Yeah, and I suppose stuff that's being processed, you don't have the time to look at every image that's coming through.
Well, that's right. It was, well, it used to feel like Carol was the final quality control on that sort of thing. You know, she's such a prude that nothing would, without being me being told. But then what we, because I had an arrangement with the police at Cambridge. And I'm just trying to think of the bloke who used to do that, a chap from Histon he was, whereby if we had anything that was really, you know, you say, well, if you get any, you know.
Yeah, pick the phone up, yeah.
Yeah, particularly involving children and things like that. And, yeah, on quite a number of occasions, you know, used to phone him up and he said, well, I'll come down and have a look and see what we're going to do about it. And on one occasion, the chap who brought some stuff in, and that involved a little girl who happened to be his daughter. But anyhow, he came down from the police station and with another policeman. And we were talking in our little passageway that used to go through from the shop out the back. And we stood there, and it was just gone 5 o'clock. And of course, all work should be ready at 5 o'clock. And of course, we always had a queue at about 5 o'clock, people waiting to get served, you know. And we stood there talking. And he said to me, how will we know which is the chap when he comes in? So I said, well, I will probably... Oh, I said, oh, there he is. So, of course, me being the coward, I was off. But they did escort him down there to the police station for a bit of questioning. And we had even one with a doctor, with a little girl in a bath, and it was not nice at all. The Americans were the biggest offenders.
Tell me a bit about running the process lab then, because you were very successful at it. I can remember you won lots of different awards year on year for the quality of your work.
That's right. Well, we won the Gold Award 2 years on the run. That was the Kodak National Award. We won that in 82 and 83.
Mm-hmm.
And your prize for winning it, which you've got all the garb that went with it so you could advertise. It did us good, in actual fact, advertising on that, because Rodney Tibbs, who of course we did work for at the Cambridge News, or mainly E6 processing, I invited him to this do that we had. Kodak said you can have 50 guests. Pick a hotel, so I said, well, Garden House, and we'll lay on a meal and so forth, and get it there, and you can have a celebrity to do the award. So, oh right. So the first one, who would you like as a celebrity? So I said, well, my son's a West Ham supporter. Can I get Trevor Brooking? He said, yes, I think we can manage that. And sure enough, they got Trevor Brooking.
Wow.
And of course, he was there, and everyone was having the photograph taken. He was a real gent, that bloke. Everyone had a photograph taken with him and autographs and so forth. And I also invited Rodney Tibbs there from the News, who used to do the motoring column and all that sort of thing. And he said, yeah, we'll get you a little bit on the go in the Cambridge News. And we had the centre spread, 2 pages, and they come around, took pictures of the old machines and all that sort of thing. So that did us a power of good.
But how prestigious were these awards, and how many different labs around the country would have been considered for it?
Yeah, anyone using Kodak materials, Kodak paper, so that was the majority of them. So that was nationwide, yeah.
Yeah, quite an achievement.
They only awarded one gold. for the year, yeah. And then we won 11 silvers, which meant we weren't good enough for the gold.
But consistent high level of performance, so obviously.
Yeah, and also Kodak gave me £50 to take the staff for a meal. In them days, that covered it, I suppose. £50 just to take me out for a drink. So they didn't feel as if they were left out. Although all the staff were at the awards.
And the advent of digital photography then, this would have started to impact you when do you think?
Well, as far as I was concerned, about a year before I packed up, before I retired. I bought the first camera that Konica brought in, because we used to deal with Konica. And if you looked at it now, you'd probably have a laugh. But, I mean, that was over £400.
Yeah.
I mean, it really was basic. But it produced a digital photo, I suppose. From that point on, I wasn't too involved. They did carry on with digital after I left. You know, they got the old computer there and Adobe they were doing and all that sort of thing. But I didn't get really involved. I used to, even after I retired, I'd still used to go in there and just help me if a machine broke down, things like that, you know, on the ordinary wet processing side. But on the digital side, and even now I'm not too well up on it, my interest sort of went. For a little while I was quite keen, I got myself a decent camera and all that sort of thing. I enjoyed messing about, and I used to do odd jobs for them, like removing blemishes and things like that, you know, on prints for them with the old digital side of things, but I don't know I'd do anything like that. But yeah, so they did fairly well for a little while, but then of course, you know, people got used to the idea of doing their own. So easy for them, isn't it? So that sort of marked the end of that. But having said that, if you look at magazines, and I'm talking now about the, because I'm in the caravan club, you look at their magazine and the MMM magazine, you see that a bloke called Andy Stothert in the MMM magazine produces fantastic photographs. He really does. They double spread them, you know. And he still uses Fujifilm. Mid-sized camera, 2¼ square, one assumes. And yeah, and he still does that. So there's still people using it, the old film, and you can still buy it, of course.
And some of the photo labs that have kept in business are doing quite well, I should imagine, now. The ones where you have the electronic interface and you upload your stuff and back comes your packet of prints.
That's right, yeah.
I think that's probably and as popular.
You've still got
it?
These the sort of the mini lab, an upmarket on the mini lab sort of thing, I think, you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I haven't really sort of kept up to date with it on that sort of side of things.
But photography, I mean, it seems more popular now than it ever has been. I mean, the digital has done that. It's made everybody a photographer almost every day of their lives, really.
Yeah.
And there's still a proportion of those that end up getting
That's
printed.
Right. Yeah. Oh, it's done the power of good for it, the digital side, and they produce good prints as well. You know, I mean, when Rodney Tibbs asked the question of this bloke who was the boss man at Kodak at the time. We had this do at the Garden House Hotel, and Rodney Tibbs asked the question, will digital photography, you know, overtake the film side of photography? And he just said, Jeff Cadogan, that was the Kodak bloke's name, he just said, no, that will never happen. Film will always reign. Wrong. Yeah, got that definitely wrong.